Tonight on Arena, Lisa O'Neill is in session with songs for that are very timely, and The Vast of the Night, The High Note and Only the Animals are the movies up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Films first this evening. The High Note is set in the world of the LA music scene. The Vast of Night is an ode to 1950s sci-fi. And Only the Animals charts an unhappily married woman's terrifying fate and her mysterious connections to five other people. John McGuire and Angela Flannery have been viewing and they're talking to me this evening about the three movies. We'll start with The Vast of Night, debut film from director Andrew Patterson. When this started, John, I thought I was getting some sort of homage to War of the Worlds. Yeah. And that's certainly what's involved. We're in that period. We're in that kind of hysteria.
That's right. This is, like you say, Sean, a debut from Andrew Patterson, a self-taught filmmaker in his early 30s. It's as good a debut film as I've seen all year. And like you say, there's shades of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and The Thing and The Blob and They Came from Space and all of those 1950s Red Scare alien invasion movies added to Spielberg's Close Encounters and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop LPs. It's some list of credentials. And this is a story that was written by James Montagu and Craig W. Sagner as an homage. But this is territory that's been well covered over the last 70 years. But these guys managed to find a new angle and in Patterson's presentation managed to make it seem fresh and exciting. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Angela, radio is a very important aspect of the story here, but I believe the first 20 minutes or so were quite a struggle for you. What was it that threw you off?
I suppose it was just the assault on your ears for the first 20 minutes, Sean, because the opening scene is in the small town high school basketball arena of the high school. And it is as people are coming in. And so you can imagine the acoustics in there. It's rubber-soled shoes. It's, you know, equipment being banged around. And the lead character in it, Everett, we meet him first and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and he's mumbling and speaking really quickly. And there's all sorts of confusion and miscommunication going on as they're trying to get this basketball game going. And he's been followed by the female lead, the two-hander essentially, Faye, who has this very high-pitched kind of whittering voice. And I mean, it really is very, very noisy and very intense and quite irritating. I was very on edge watching it. And that goes on for kind of 15 minutes. And then the two of them leave and walk through the town. And it continues in this very high speed exchange of information about technology because she's a bit of a science nerd and he's a radio nerd. And I mean, really, you know, sitting there watching it, you feel like you're being blinded by science. And it took me a while to go, this has got to be deliberate because I'm really uncomfortable just with the assault, the auditory assault of it. But of course it is completely deliberate. And if you stick with it for those 15 minutes, boy, does it pay off. I'm really glad I did stick with it.
Yeah, because sometimes you don't even know who the characters are. It took me a long time to work out who was actually talking to whom and what they were saying. Their backs were to the camera for quite a lot of it, which was quite a brave move in some ways. But that radio aspect, John, becomes vital, in fact, to the way Patterson tells the story.
It's the whole mechanism by which these two nerds, and they're the closest thing you got to nerds in the 1950s. One runs his own little one-room radio station. The other is a switchboard operator, played by Sienna McCormick. And what happens, the way that they, in their rural, isolated New Mexico town, they become aware of something happening outside in the wider world is through strange frequencies and eerie oscillating tones that they find first on the phone lines at the switchboard and then interrupting the radio signal at the studio. And calls start coming into the switchboard. Terrified people have seen things in the sky. And then another call comes into the radio studio that suggests a cause for the sound and sets in train a kind of a treasure hunt to solve the mystery, or if not solve it exactly, to intensify the mystery.
Right. And that call that comes through comes from a character called Billy, played by Bruce Davis. And in the clip I'm about to play, Faye, played by Sierra McCormick, has put the call through to Everett, played by Jake Horowitz. He's on air. And Billy is going to give some information about the sounds that they have been hearing.
Everett, we got a caller. him through.
He's out of town. It sounds like I might know something.
Then put him through now, Faye. Come on, please.
Sir, we are connecting you now.
Hello, sir. This is Everett Sloan. Can you hear me?
Hello, yes. How are you?
I'm good. Can I get your name?
Yes, my name is Billy.
Billy. Okay, thank you, Billy. And I need to tell you first, we don't allow any swear words or inappropriate stories on the air. I could lose my job. And I don't have a delay here, and I want to put you right through onto the air, but I need you to promise me that we're safe in doing so.
Of course, I understand. I don't swear talk like that anyway in my life.
Okay, I'm breaking the rules to do this, so please, you know, be honest with me. Maybe ask me if you think something needs to be discussed off the air, and I'll go to a break and put on a record, all right?
Okay, I can do that.
All right, we are going on the air here shortly in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, we're back, everybody. Sorry to cut that last song short, but we do have a caller here who may know something. Now, Billy, would you mind telling us all what you know?
Billy, played by Bruce Davies. Everett, played by Jake Horowitz. He's the radio host. And Sierra McCormick, the telephonist there, playing the character of Faye, the telephonist, rather, who puts the call through to the radio. Angela, you were saying you were really glad that you stuck with it, but I just want to stick with that phone call for a moment. Mm-hmm. That's entirely in voiceover. We never see the character who makes the phone call. We just see the reactions of Jake Horowitz to the call. And I don't know if the camera moves very much during maybe 5 or 6 minutes of that phone call. It's very brave in that respect.
It is. It's very experimental. It is, as you say, very, very brave, but it's so effective as well. I mean, I think it's about 5 minutes long, and it is just, you know, the camera is on the Everett character and it is all about the audio. And then suddenly it fades to black. So you can imagine if you're sitting in a cinema watching this, you are going to be in pitch blackness. And for 2 minutes, you just have the voice of Bruce Davies. And what an amazing voice actor he is. Mm. I mean, you're really transported with it. It's a very ambitious thing to do. It could have fallen flat on his face, but it actually works really, really well. People who like radio are going to love this film, particularly people who have an interest in old radio, you know, sort of the early days of radio. And, you know, I don't know anything whatsoever about Jake Horowitz. I think this is a screen debut. He just did an incredible turn as the local radio star. You know, when he goes into persona once he's on air, he starts reading out all of the show sponsors, calling out requests. He knows all of the listeners because there, you know, it's local radio. There's a competition to win a square of Elvis Presley's carpet, which of course is a fake. It's just fantastic. Yeah. It kind of brings, if anyone knows Garrison Keillor, WLR Radio Romance, that novel, it brought me right back into that. And I mean, I love radio, so I loved it. So if you're a radio nerd, you're going to like this movie.
The other thing, John, is, you know, it's showing on Amazon Prime. Obviously, the films that we're reviewing are available online since cinemas are closed. But in America, it's been shown at drive-in movie theatres. This is a film made for drive-in movie, isn't it?
Can you imagine? Wouldn't it be just amazing? The atmosphere that Patterson is able to conjure on a very low budget. Now, he very cleverly cuts his cloth. There isn't money for elaborate CGI or pyrotechnics, so he keeps the flashy stuff to a minimum and emphasises the material that he can work with, predominantly the audio. The 1950s slang and the dialogue, rock and roll music, like you say, the hypnotic monologues, and an amazing use of music and sound, tones, frequencies, the human voice. All of those elements are brilliantly executed by what I thought was a young director with great promise, enormous promise.
All right. I think you both enjoyed this. If it did take you a little while to get there, Angela. So let's start with your stars Vast of Night, gone out of my head. The Vast of Night. Angela?
Well, Sean, I would have to say that, you know, this has been critically very well received, but I don't think it's going to be everyone's cup of tea. I mean, I would love to go and see it. I'd love to go to a drive-in movie theatre and see it, listen through my radio. It's my kind of thing. If you like old B-movies, if you're into Americana, if you like the 50s, if you're a radio nerd, if you like David Lynch and the B-52s, you're going to love this. If you don't, I think you might find it contrived and pretentious and you may not get beyond the first 15 minutes of it. But I liked it, so I'm giving it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from you. And what are you saying, John?
Well, what I like most about it, Sean, was that it's told without the deadening thud of irony these tropes that he's playing with are so ingrained in the culture, they've been referenced and satirized and postmoderned to death. And it's a brave filmmaker who tried to winkle them out and turn them into something new. And I think he did that. I think he succeeded in that. 4 stars for me. It's the best film I've seen since the lockdown began.
All
I
right.
really enjoyed it.
And if you want to see it, it's available on Amazon Prime from tomorrow, the 29th of May. I heard them talking about, that's the Fast of Night, I heard them talking about drive-in gigs in Limerick, in and around Dolan. So maybe drive-in movies will solve all of our cinema problems if somebody has the money and the inclination to go ahead with that. Let's move on then to The High Note, again available on Amazon Prime. Latest movie from director Nisha Ganatra shares a few of the themes she explored in her 2015 movie Late Night, which had Emma Thompson, kind of a story of a TV host whose star is waning. In High Note, youthful ambition clashes with fading stardom, not in the TV studio but on the music stage. Angela, whose star is waning in The High Note?
Yeah, it tells the story of legendary singer Grace Davis, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross, who's the daughter of Diana Ross. And so, you know, she's struggling to get ahead in the man's world, as is her personal assistant. But the Grace's issue is that she hasn't written or sung any new material for years, and she's feeling quite, you know, creatively down in the dumps and defunct. And she's, shock horror, in her 40s. So the radio executives and her record company, basically, they just want to keep rolling out the greatest hits and live albums. And now, to top it all, they want her to go and do a residency in Las Vegas. Her personal assistant, Maggie, who is played by Dakota Johnson. Would rather be a music producer than a personal assistant. And so she feels that really Grace is selling out by doing this, and that, you know, there's still plenty of gas in the tank, and that she should reinvent herself, modernize herself. And she secretly starts to take edits of old Grace Davis tracks and to remaster them, and plays them to her boss. And will they go with it? No, they won't, because Grace's manager, Jack, who's played by Ice Cube, has, you know, thinks, who is this little imposter, and really she should go away. And both Grace and Maggie are patronised within an inch of their life by the men around them. Well, and that's
the basic premise of this one, for sure. Well, Ice Cube, as you said, plays the character of the music manager, Jack Robertson. Grace Davis, played by Tracy Ellis Ross. Dakota Johnson plays her assistant, Maggie. And let's hear a clip where precisely that kind of patronising that you talk about, Angela, is going on.
It's just one simple meet. The label guys want to know all about Vegas. You know what? Let's just talk about this later. Continue to do your ukulele shit.
I don't want to sit with a bunch of label guys who... What is it?
Have to be reminded
that I'm still alive.
What do we sit here and talk about?
I've already done a greatest hits album and a live album, and now a greatest hits live album? What?
Okay. Look, when I agreed to come back, what did you promise me? Huh? You said you was gonna listen to me this time. All I wanna do is play it safe so we can stack some money.
It's pathetic.
You pathetic, because you're arguing with me and your ass should be on vocal rest.
I will decide what I want to do next.
Yeah.
Give me the popsicles, Maggie.
Yeah.
You always walk away. Grace.
Ice Cube as music manager Jack Robertson there, Grace played by Tracy Ellis Ross, and Maggie, Grace's assistant, played by Dakota Johnson, doing the voicing for her, because poor old Grace has lost her voice at that point in time. We mentioned Diana Ross's daughter, who it is who's playing the character of Grace here, John, but the scriptwriter Flora Gleason, is it, there are some parallels in her own story, and this is her debut screenplay?
As far as I know, it's her debut screenplay, but I didn't know anything about her as a writer or her previous career. It'd be really interesting if she did have the inside track on how music is made in Los Angeles and what happens when superannuated acts end up in Las Vegas doing karaoke for the buffet crowd, but I didn't really get any sense of that in Gantra's treatment of the film. It's ironic, really, that in a film that's ostensibly about the need to take risks to create art and to sacrifice comfort for the reward of making something new, that the high note is as formulaic as they come. It's as comfortable and easy a ride as you're going to get this year. Highly polished studio work, a bit of drama, a bit of light comedy, a little romance. Particularly the character played by Kelvin Harris Jr., the young singer that Maggie picks up on, starts working with him and leading to a kind of a standoff between these two women's varying ambitions. All of that is quite well worked because it fits a formula. But apart from that, there's not a lot here that we haven't seen before with interchangeable elements.
What about the music, Angela? Who performs the music actually here? Because there's a lot of live performance, or what looks like live performance at any rate.
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's. It's actually the first time that Tracy Ellis Ross has sung in a role, which is incredible considering she's in her late 40s. And I kept thinking back to Lady Sings the Blues, Diana Ross's debut as an actress in the early 70s, which I haven't seen for years, but remember loving it. I was much younger. I don't know if it stands the test of time. But Tracy Ellis Ross can sing. I'm just amazed that she has never done it before. And so she really, for me, if there is a star in this, it was her and what she did. And I thought there was great chemistry between her and Dakota Johnson as well. But I have to say, when you're asking about the music, as the film progresses, and no spoilers here, but as the story and the narrative progresses, and there's sort of the musical finale in particular is so saccharine. I mean, these people have got good voices, and obviously, you know, an awful lot went into the production of the music in this. The final, it's a duet. I won't say more than that, but it sounds like country music. I mean, it's so middle of the road. And as John says, you know, it really, in the end, you end up feeling that actually the film has gone the way that Grace was trying to avoid going with her career, which was just taking the money and run. Yeah. Because I couldn't figure out what this film was about. You know, I really thought, is it a drama? There's one really good scene in it where, you know, Grace has just been, I mean, really, really condescended to in a meeting room full of men. She goes into the bathroom and is in tears, and she launches into this monologue where she says to Maggie, you know how naive you are. There has never in the history of music been a number one hit by a woman over 40, a black woman over 40. So look at me, where am I going to go? You know, you need to wake up. And then you kind of think that's what this film started out about. Like, you're suddenly reminded that that's what this was supposed to be about, these two women getting ahead. But basically it falls into the whole big dark black hole of a romantic comedy as soon as the male love interest enters. And then it just turns into a different film. So I really didn't know, is this a drama? Is it a rom-com? Is it a musical? And the writing is quite patchy as well. I mean, Ice Cube vanishes. The Jack character vanishes for a full half an hour in this film, when the conflict that's set up initially and sparks are flying are between Jack and Maggie, and then he disappears as soon as David, the love interest, arrives. And one or two other things about the writing that just didn't sit really well with me was that there were two actors in this that I was really excited to see in the cast. And they were Mark Evan Jackson, who plays the sort of slimy, radio company guy. People will know him as Sean, the main demon in The Good Place. He's the guy who presides over the bad place. And he's really good at sarcastic, unctuous type of characters. And then Eddie Izzard appears about two thirds of the way through it. And he's this kind of washed up looking rock star that's sort of overweight. And he kind of looks like an overweight, embittered David Bowie tribute act. And he's only there as a narrative device to get Maggie out of the spot of bother. He has about three lines and then he disappears, and it's just like, what? Come back, Eddie Izzard.
I felt disappointed by devices, because we'd be here all night. Even if Ganatra can't find a moment of genuine dramatic conflict, that she doesn't feel obliged to resolve completely to everybody's satisfaction a couple of scenes later. And that's what deadens a lot of the film, is the requirement for anything that's put forward to be tidily squared away a couple of scenes later. And it just reveals the formula at play, and that's a fatal kind of thing that you do in this kind of film. But there's a comfort in it, and there's a joy in seeing it done well. And like Angela said, the regular music numbers are very distinctive, and Ross has a remarkable voice. But there's a lot else that they could have done a bit better.
Stars from you, John?
Oh, three.
Three from you, and average, from you, Angela?
Straight down the middle.
Two and a half.
It's a very tired 2.5. Although some people might give out to you a little bit about saying it ends up being a country song. Although I think you were referring to the direction in which he was pushed there. Right, we've one more film to talk about. We'll talk about it after. And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Now, we've already spoken about The High Note and The Vast of Night in our movie reviews tonight. And when we were talking about The Vast of Night, by the way, I mentioned, wow, drive-in movies would be great to see that. Well, I am told in the last 10 minutes that there are some drive-in movies happening in June, in fact, in Kilkenny, Galway, Fairy House and Leopardstown. And the website to find out what movies have been shown there is retrodrivein.ie. So there you go. There's your big chance for a drive-in movie in the next month. Sure, it's only a couple of days away at this stage, isn't it? Now, let us move on to movie number three, Only the Animals, from the French film director Dominic Moll. The premise here, John, we're in the south of France, but a very cold south of France, certainly in the opening sections.
In the Central Massif of France, actually.
Oh,
showed,
sorry. Beg your pardon.
Where a neighbor's car has been found on the side of the road by Alice, played by Laura Calamy, who's a married social worker who's having an affair with a client named Joseph, played by Damien Bonnard. And when the cops question Joseph, he claims to know nothing about the missing driver, played by Valeria Brune Tedeschi, who was herself having an affair with a waitress, but in fact, her dead body is wrapped in a blanket in a press in his house. Now, this is all happening in the first couple of minutes of the film. I'm not revealing anything. The story is broken into five chapters titled after the characters' names, Alice, Michel, Joseph, and jumps backwards and forwards in time and backwards and forwards from France to Guyana in Africa, although the witting or unwitting involvement of some of the characters is something that we're not going to go into here. It's a bit beyond the scope of our synopsis. But still, why does Alice's husband, Michel, played by Denis Ménochet, who's the farmer, if you remember, in the opening scene of Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, why does he have a cut on his face? What does an internet scammer sitting in Africa online, what does he have to do with any of this? And this is a very ambitiously structured thriller, a very well-staged thriller, like you say, from Dominic Moll, who people might remember 20 years ago made a film called Harry, He's Here to Help, which was another kind of Hitchcockian, fractured Hitchcockian thriller, and will appeal to fans of Rashomon or Memento or any of those kind of multilinear mysteries, but also TV shows like Broadchurch or Collateral, in which you have many characters playing a role in a central mystery, and we have to tease it out. And that's as I was watching it, and the way it's structured, all I could think of was Godard's famous maxim that a film should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order. And that's what Moll is playing around with here. And he does it very well. He does it extremely well.
Yes, but you do have to. I mean, I watched this late last evening, and I found that, first of all, obviously you're dealing with subtitles because it's in French, but you are dealing with those backwards and forwards moments in time, Angela. And that does demand, if you found the first 20 minutes of The Vast of Night that you had to have your head screwed on, you certainly have to concentrate as you're watching this. But again, I would argue there's a payoff.
Yeah, I do have to concentrate. I think you can just let it wash over you. I really enjoyed this because I love non-linear storytelling. I'm not a fan of the rising action and the beginning, middle and end and, you know, the three-act scenario. I don't particularly like that. I like to kind of, I find that I'm not often surprised by it, and very often I would guess what's going to happen, or I'd find myself trying to guess. You didn't get a chance with this film to do that because of all of the interconnected stories. You're just watching each person's story, and suddenly you're going, oh, that's how they relate to the other person. And they're walking in and out of each other's stories, and it's episodic, and it flips, you know, it's non-linear, so it flips forwards and backwards in time. And often you see the same scene being played out again from the perspective of the other character. And I just found it really engaging. I enjoyed it so much. I think it was really controlled, well done. I didn't disbelieve it, except for the very final connection, which is the final scene. But the rest of it, I just completely suspended my disbelief and I was gone. I was going with him on this. Dominic Moll had me.
Yeah, and absolutely. You both, Angela and yourself, John, you both chose or singled out the performance of Denis Ménochet, who plays the character of Michel. Why was he so compelling for you, John?
Well, I've always liked him. Every time he pops up, the first time I'd say I saw him was in Inglourious Basterds, but I've seen him in a few films since, particularly a French film from a couple of years ago called Custody, in which he's just extraordinary. And he just has one of those faces, one of those bodies. He's like, you know, a slightly lumpier, younger Gerard Depardieu. He's just come out compelling to look at. And as a fine actor, he's really good at playing the kind of character that he plays here, who is somebody who on the surface might seem beaten and cowed by the circumstances that he's in, but there is that spark of intelligence working behind that that makes itself more apparent as the story goes on. Now, I found that some of the sections here are more effective than others, and one or two of them dragged for me a little bit, but there is an enormous satisfaction when the intricate logic that Maul is playing with, when it finally clicks into place. This is a complex story told without ever feeling the need to spoon feed us the information. While we're busy solving the great mystery at the heart of the film, the disappearance of this woman and how she died, Maul is formulating a bigger mystery about how lust and greed warp people's minds and make them do things that they would otherwise never consider doing. And that's really good. That's really engaging adult grown-up drama and great fun to watch.
Yeah, and the other aspect of that is, Angela, it's based on a novel. And of course, you can flip back and forth in time in a novel, I think, an awful lot easier than you can do in film in some ways. Or certainly there are literary tricks that you can use to bring the reader along with you. Maul seems to have the adaptation seems to grasp all of that pretty well.
Well, I absolutely want to read the novel after reading it. It really made me wonder how faithful it was to the novel. The novel originally was written by Colin Nile, who I know absolutely nothing about, but I would certainly go out and buy it and read it. And there's layers happening here as well that I you know, I liked. It's a lot. There are five love stories. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. All of these people just want to be loved. And all of them are kind of unlovable in their own way. And they're all chasing after an unattainable love. They've idealized love. You know, they're chasing after fantasies, and they all end up heartbroken or rejected and, well, you know, potentially dead.
Stars.
So
stars.
It's dark. It's definitely dark.
Stars from you,
four
Angela.
And a half from
four
me.
And
I loved
from
it.
Four and a half from Angela and from you, John.
Well, four for me, Shauna. It's a top. This is a list French cinema. This is as good as it gets at the moment.
Okay, John McGuire and Angela Flannery there. Only the Animals is available on Curzon Home Cinema, while the first two films we spoke about, Vast of Night and The High Note, are both available on Amazon Prime. Captain, the title of that track from Nicole Atkins. It's from her fifth album, Italian Ice, which is out tomorrow. Today was a great day. It gives me great pleasure to say that after a few quiet weeks in lockdown, our Studio 8 music sessions are back up and running. And earlier this afternoon, singer-songwriter Lisa O'Neill came in to us to play a few beautiful songs and have a chat ahead of a very special gig she will be doing as part of the National Concert Hall live stream series on June the 12th. She started with a brand new song, a song called The Strangeness of It All.
The strangeness which I won't miss, the number counting you's at six. I wash, I wish, I watch. The strangeness I hope we keep, the seagulls squeak, the street asleep, we share a lullaby.
The strangeness of all of this, performed for us by Lisa O'Neill. The strangeness of all of this is exactly what we have to speak about. First of all, Lisa, because this is our first Studio 8 session since lockdown. You're the first guest. Delighted that you are that. I'm sitting about, what am I now, at least 12 foot away from you, in fact. There are two Perspex screens between us.
It's bizarre.
It really is odd, the strangeness of all of this.
Yeah.
But that song
tells us exactly what you've been feeling. My first question was going to be, what's it like in lockdown?
Well, that's a couple of little details, you know. Sometimes you think you're going mad. And then I go, is this the right end of mad? Because, I don't know, I'm growing in all of this. I needed, this is a very sad time.
Mm.
I know. And a scary time. But I needed this intervention. I haven't stopped to collect myself in years. And it's just lovely to sit still and not be able to move away from staring at one wall, you know. Oh, look, it is very strange. It's a worrying time. But somehow the fear seems to be lifting a little bit.
Well, you touch on it in the song in a couple of ways. I mean, you're very clear on talking about the news at 6. I'm lucky enough on this programme that Monday to Friday, I'm not watching the news at 6 because I am getting ready for 7 o'clock. At the weekends, I'm there and I watch those on the roll call and those pictures of some of the people who have died. It's actually heartbreaking. And obviously that news at 6 and listening to the number count, as you put it in the song.
Yeah, well, it's the radio I'd be collecting it from myself. But I've heard about the faces coming up and it's so sad. I don't know what to say, you know. Mm. And I've some friends who've lost their parents. I've a nurse. I'm a cousin, my cousin's a nurse. She's working her heart off out in Manchester. And this is her duty, she says, you know. And it's a mad time, Sean.
And have you spoken to her then on Zoom or just over the phone?
No, just some text messages and stuff. And she's so strong. But, you know, there's so many of her out there as well. They're amazing. The front line are just...
Yeah.
They're heroes, aren't they? I know everybody's saying it, but there's no other word for them.
And I suppose it's important to remember just how many people are on the front line. It's not just the health workers.
It's the people working in Tesco.
Yeah, it's the bin men who are taking the rubbish away for us. It's the guards. It's everybody who's out there doing their thing.
It's the taxi man who brought me here today.
Yeah.
With his screen in the back as well. Yeah, so we have to start making this conversation a little more interesting by looking at the closer detail of the strangeness of it all.
And let's look at one of the details that's clearly been catching either your eyes or your ears in the middle of Dublin City. The seagulls. They're very active around your area at the moment, are they?
They love the... Well, I'm not going to tell you my address across the wireless.
No, I don't expect that, but no.
But they love the tall streets. You know, it's an amplifier for them. It's mating season. And they can hear themselves really well there. But I read an article as well. Do you know, we're hearing the birds differently. We're hearing nature differently because everything has slowed down. You know, the noise of the city has slowed down. And the blackbirds, for example, they're singing a little quieter because they don't have to compete with the noise of the city. I wrote another song about where the female blackbird is a little bit stunned and freaked out because she doesn't recognise her mate's song because it's so gentle.
Wow. So he's not aggressively seeking a mate anymore. He's kind of quietly seducing.
He's gently saying, I'm here. You know who I am. Yeah.
So the lyric in the song, the strangeness I want to keep, those are the things you want to keep.
The things that I've noticed that I hadn't noticed so much before. Well, I always noticed the seagulls since I moved to this area. But no, I mean, I think we're all taking a little closer look at our environment as well. And I'm getting to know my neighbours. And I'm getting to know corners of the area around me that I hadn't had a chance to have a look at before. It's quite enlightening, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You see things and you... I actually find I'm talking to my neighbours. I always spoke to them, but I'm talking to them more now, always, you know, a couple of metres away. But we have longer conversations because, you know, we want to socially interact with people safely.
Well, that's it. And in the city, you know, all these windows you're looking at, they're like little boxes, but the lives that are going on behind them, the mystery, you know. Sometimes a light goes off in a house over here on the left and at the exact same time a light goes off up here as well. All this, I don't know, I'm having a good old time staring out the window, to be honest, Sean. This pace is just right for me.
And clearly all of that stuff, or am I right when I say clearly, is that feeding directly into the type of songs that you're writing? Are you making up stories about whoever it is over on the left-hand side who's turning off his or her light and whoever it is over on the other side?
Oh, I never make them up. Oh no, only the truth. I don't know. There's world building happening, I suppose, and I've been painting a little bit and drawing characters and just having fun with it all. My heart's breaking a little bit, missing my parents. I'd love to see them. I'd really like to see them.
They're up at home in Cavan.
They're in Cavan.
Yeah.
But they're well, and I look forward to seeing them when but you know, everybody's feeling that.
Yeah. And again, would you do Zoom calls or would you do FaceTime with them?
No.
You're not a great technology woman, I don't think so.
I am a true technophobe. I'm probably not even saying that right, you know? That's how bad I am. So, but I'm learning. I actually bought a couple of microphones since all this happened, so I'm learning to use them. So maybe I'm not too bad.
Mm. One of the things that you've been doing during lockdown, you've been telling me, Lisa O'Neill, is rowing.
Rowing a Cork.
Where?
On the Liffey.
With whom?
Yeah, with a group. We call ourselves Dríoch na Liffey, which is the magic of life. And there's six of us at the moment. We go out in these Corks and we went 8K the other day. It was just wonderful to be on the water. And I'm very slow at this. My arms have to get stronger and stronger, but I'm loving it.
And are you far enough away from each other and everything like that in the boat, or how does that work?
Yes, we are. We're 2 metres apart. We're doing everything right. Normally, we would be 3 on the boat. Now we're 2 on a boat, so O'Neill has to work harder.
2 of you? I mean, how big is the boat? If it normally takes 3 people to row it and it's just 2, that's a lot
well,
more effort.
Well, if I lay down twice, I think it would be that length.
So what, 10 foot or something like that, 12 foot, somewhere between 10 and 12 foot.
I'll measure and I'll tell you next time I see you, Sean. What's the length of a Cork?
Maybe people will know and they'll text in and tell us.
I think they will.
And is there some, I suppose, even the sound of the water, is there a relaxation in that activity?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. The sound of the strokes in the water. Then to go under the bridges, to go under O'Connell Bridge, it takes quite a while. The echo's unbelievable. I've been singing Old Man River going under that bridge. Oh, yeah.
That's lucky for the person who's in the boat with you. To be in the boat
with
Lisa.
So. If he likes it, not getting sick of that song. I'm learning Kevin Barry now at the moment. You know, Kevin Barry will be, he is 100 years dead this year.
And the song?
Well, I guess because Paul Robinson has been singing Kevin Barry and he's singing Old Man River. I'm completely deflecting here. Sorry. Rowing on the Liffey is a real thing.
Mm.
And I've been loving it. And we hope for more action on the Liffey in the future. My friends, they say it's the garden in Dublin that is not being used properly. It is a garden. The watery garden.
Well, if you're going to talk about Kevin Barry, then I'm going to automatically ask you for a song. I love hearing you sing because you have the banjo in with you today as well. You're going to sing The Lass of Ockram for me?
I will indeed. Okay. Oh, the rain falls on my heavy locks and dew soaks my skin. My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in.
The Lass of Ockram performed for us in this lovely Studio 8 session that I'm getting to enjoy more and more, Lisa O'Neill performing. The other thing that you're preparing for, are you writing songs for the album at the moment? Are the songs that we're hearing today, are they definitely for the album, or are you just gathering, or is the album done?
They're for present, they're for now, but I mean, maybe they'll end up on an album. I'm writing an album as well, and that is what I was supposed to be doing at this time, was sitting put and kind of collecting the ideas I've gathered since the last album and, you know, getting ready to go again. So I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're part of the National Concert Hall events that are coming up on the Concert Hall stage by yourself. It's 12th of June, I think, is actually yours.
Yeah.
You know, we spoke with Tara Rock and Barry Douglas about this. Tara is on tomorrow night and in fact her concert's going out. It's the first of the series. Big empty concert hall, just you and your guitar, nobody in the audience. Have you thought much about that? Have you thought about the song, type of songs you'll be singing? Presumably like what you've just done.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. It's a lovely thing to work towards, you know. Yeah, I'm thinking all the time about what to sing, and it's an hour, so I haven't decided on it all yet. It's going to be strange to... I haven't done any of these Zoom concerts or anything like that, you know, because it's just... Fair play to anyone who's doing it, but for me, to pretend that there's somebody there listening to me, even if they, you know, they are somewhere up there in the cyber world listening to me, I'm not receiving it. And so it feels like maybe a conversation with the wall. So I'm going to have to find a way of working that out in my head. Maybe the cameraman can be my audience. But I do need to speak to somebody.
Yeah.
You know? I'm speaking to you now, Sean. I can see you. You're real. I feel that my ideas aren't real if I don't see them, if I don't observe them being received and understood.
And so if you're recording an album in studio, then are the engineers and the people working around you, they're your audience, are they?
Yes, and my muses, who I might have had in mind when I was writing the songs. But they're always there, and maybe that's who I need to bring into the concert hall with me.
But I'm guessing that the final song that you're going to perform for us this evening, Lisa, is about one of those muses, a woman called Mary Harris, also known as Mother Jones. Tell me a little bit about her.
Amazing woman, and I only discovered her recently myself through a documentary that RTE made called Her Story. But Mother Jones was an incredible woman, born in the 1830s in Cork, and her family emigrated to Toronto in and around the Great Famine. It's very hard to brief this because it's a massive, massive story, and it's very hard to brief it in a song. So my song basically is an introduction to this woman's life. It's very fact-based. But she knew hardship, and she lost her four children and her husband, George Jones, who was also an activist, who she loved dearly. She lost them through the yellow fever. And she describes in her book washing down their bodies and wrapping them up for burial all on her own. She did okay a little bit after that. She went and opened up a dressmaking company in Chicago with another Irish woman, making fancy dresses for the well-to-do. But the whole time she was just heartbroken looking at the poor people on the street and the working class and the conditions that they were living in. Chicago went on fire one summer. She lost everything again. And then she joined a union. And she was a powerful woman. She made her way around the mines of America and dragged the men out of the mines and said, "We're going on strike. I'm going to show you how to go on strike. We need to fight for the 8-hour working day. You have rights. You're entitled to your rights." And one of the big things that she had a huge hand in was the abolition of child labour in America. I mean, that's massive. They were sending little children who were small enough to go down tiny little holes down trenches, you know?
Yeah.
They mightn't come out of these trenches. Some of them died. It was madness. So she had a huge heart, and she had a great wit. And there was a journalist from the New York Times who was very taken by her, and he followed her around. I mean, the work she did went on for years and years, and he followed her around. And these lines that she came out with during her strikes and her protests were huge. And one of the lines that really stands out to me, and I think is relevant today, and I think that if Mother Jones was alive today, she'd be screaming it. And this line is, "Pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living."
Yeah.
So out of all the hardship that she went through, the strength she got out of it and the things she did with that, she was known as the most dangerous woman in America. A judge said that to her. Most dangerous woman for having such a big heart, because she moved things. You know, she moved things with her pain and with her sadness and her grief.
Well,
I can't shout enough about her.
Yeah, well, that's why you wrote the song, I guess. And it's a gent. You're not shouting at us like the blackbird and the seagull. You're kind of singing it gently to us. But the fighting words, indeed, "Fight Like Hell for the Living," from Lisa O'Neill.
Fight like hell
Fight Like Hell for the Living. Lisa O'Neill there. And so great to be back in Studio 8 for those sessions. And major thanks to the sound operator this afternoon, Tom Norton. Reflections, a solo concert with Lisa O'Neill, takes place online Friday the 12th of June as part of the NCH live stream series. Tara Rockton, Dervla Collins tomorrow night, Paul Noonan, Bellex One on June the 5th. Lisa, as I said, on June the 12th. And then Barry Douglas on June the 19th. You'll find out full details on the NCH YouTube channel. It'll be available worldwide and on Facebook and RTE.ie, NCH.ie will bring all of those details together for you. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound on sound supervision here in studio this evening was from Mark McGrath. And tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan.